welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Theodore Roosevelt's complicated legacy with race and Native Americans, plus a complete reading of the Declaration of Independence from one of North Dakota's most trusted voices. But we begin today in Medora. We're getting very excited for our live broadcast from Medora this weekend. Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson will cover the ceremony of the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, and Eric Dethridge will take you on a tour of the stunning library grounds and inside the unique library, which, while void of books, promises to transform visitors and help them discover more about themselves. And why you wouldn't think of museum cafeteria food as being part of a transformative experience, that's exactly the thought behind what's on the menu at the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Here's more from Eric and another familiar voice.
Who better than a grandpa to introduce this story?
Extreme Pride.
That's Mick Kerr, a name you might recognize if you watch local morning TV news in the Red River Valley in the 90s and aughts. He was the jack of all trades at KVLY, anchorman, weatherman, and the guy who would tell you if you were going to school or not when those notorious North Dakota snowstorms hit. He now is the meteorologist and agriculture reporter at Ag News 890 in Fargo. Candace Stock, you might recognize that name. She is a rising star in the Midwestern culinary world. She took a high-profile gig as executive chef at the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, which is opening this weekend.
I've watched her at various locations. After she graduated from the Culinary Institute of America, she was in New York for a while, and then she went down to Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina for a while. And then she went out to Montana to work at a country club. She came back, Birnbaum's in downtown Fargo. Everybody misses her food there.
Candace is not only known for her tasty creations, using earthy and foraged ingredients from North Dakota and Minnesota, but as something extremely useful, especially if health problems mount.
Food is medicine. Her foraging takes her out into the woods, and she collects plants that are edible. A few years ago, I had a stent put in, well, actually three of them put in my chest, and she came up with a recipe for oatmeal along with some other seeds. It's just awesome.
Her grandfather shares his hopes for what diners take away from Salt and Scoria, Candace's restaurant named after a native plant and the fire-formed red rock that gives the Badlands its color.
I hope there is a enhanced, not just appreciation, but respect for the only people in North Dakota who are not immigrants. Those who were here for thousands of years and had a thriving and excellent society and culture for so many years.
I had the chance to tour the TR Library last week during a soft opening. I spoke with Candace in the dining room of Salt and Scoria, a bit of a TV chef star in the making as well. I started by asking Candace what she'd want to show the late Anthony Bourdain, fellow Culinary Institute of America alum, if he were still with us today.
You know, I think first I would take him into the Badlands because what we do with our menu here is very much tied to the land, but the flavors that come from here, we try to keep it punchy and acidic and bright and herbaceous because that is what is here. When you go out and pick the herbs, when you go out and pick the berries, they have that bite, and so do the people. And so it's inspired by the people, it's inspired by the land, and it's just beautiful. And I think that that's what I like to appreciate when I come here, is complimenting my food to the people that have made it what it is, but also never forgetting the indigenous history here and how these medicines were applied in food, and being able to share that, because right now I think there just hasn't been a lot of variety out here. It's pretty disconnected from big cities, but I want people to learn how to utilize these ingredients so that they can appreciate them in their homes and, yeah, just see what's obtainable.
Well, you know, people that are coming out here, tourists from all over the country and the world, think about the Old West and cowboys and stuff. I would expect that they're expecting to get something akin to the pitchfork fondue down the street. And then they come in here and there's all these flavorful ingredients from around this region that you create into these amazing, beautiful dishes. What has been in this little soft launch been the reaction so far?
So for the people that have come into the restaurant, they've just been incredibly grateful. And we've been able to accommodate for a lot of dietary restrictions or people feeling not that they can't go out because they'll never be able to find something that is good for them or that really avoids their allergens. And so we're trained in that. But also the indigenous diet focuses on less grains. We do have a very talented pastry chef here. And so I feel like that's going to end up, you know, bringing us down when it comes to the health standards. But at the same time, we're sourcing beautiful flour. It's actually called the Rough Rider. And the grain was developed at NDSU and Doubting Thomas Farms in Minnesota grows it. But that's what we're using for all of our bread. That's what we're using for all of our pastries. It's got an earthy and nutty quality to it, but connecting people to where they can find these things so that they can have them in their home too has been amazing, and that they want to know. Everybody asks, where are you getting your bison? Oh, it's from Tender Bison, but we just found someone locally, and so we're going to get some bison from them. And it's attracting more people that are so involved in their craft and so passionate, and that's exactly what we want. I don't know any farmer that's not absolutely passionate about their ingredients, about what they have, and I want people to know them.
Fresher, more natural, more earthy ingredients. Obviously, you mentioned people with restricted diets, those that are trying to eat lower carbs, lower sugars. There seems to be a lot of thought that goes into that. And, you know, this museum, this library is a teaching kind of moment. They want people to walk away inspired and think about something that relates to themselves. How do you think food plays a role in that sort of teaching learning experience?
I would say, for me, a lot of my life lessons are tied to food memories. And whether they pick something up within the exhibits or just being outside with their families, I'd say that the element of comforting food, food that makes their body feel good, not fatigued or exhausted, like something that literally nourishes their body and gives them energy, they'll have a more positive experience leaving, but their memories all kind of tie in together. I mean, you could go through the exhibits and then come out here, and if we were serving like really heavy cheeseburgers and you went home, you would think about how you went home and you were uncomfortable in the car and had a gut ache and all of that. And we don't want that for people. We want people to literally get out and experience the Badlands. Like the goal is to get good food and get sunlight and fresh air and really enjoy this space.
Well, be active. Don't sit on the couch. Get in the arena, you know, as Theodore Roosevelt said. So indigenous food is not monolithic. There's no one sort of thing where you can say, well, it's, you know, pizza and spaghetti, or it's sushi or whatever. It's a giant spectrum of foods and ingredients. And is there any sort of specific food ways that you're trying to represent as far as from the different nations around here that's unique to this part of the world?
So I grew up in northern Minnesota, and so I bring wild rice. But as far as like what indigenous people would have been eating from across this land, we try to incorporate those ingredients and always have them the focal point for whatever it is. For our sandwich, we have a bison sandwich, and it comes with a tomato jam, some greens. It's on a sourdough bread with cranberry and wild rice in it. But like when you break down any of my recipes, it's very few components. It's very few ingredients within. It's like you just want those ingredients to shine because you need to honor that spirit. You need to honor the spirit of the bison, the spirit of the raspberry. We're going in the month of July, and it's like my favorite story to tell is the story of the raspberry. But for people to come away with a little bit more intention in their food, they don't forget it.
Are there any displays or any information that you give about the ingredients to the people that are coming in that they can take away?
So we're training all of our staff on where everything is coming from so that they can communicate that information. But we're also featuring any of the farmers that we're working with on our website so people can see their story, how to source their ingredients. I think coffee is a really fun one, and that we're working with a roaster in Fargo, North Dakota called Thunder Coffee. And they have curated a really beautiful blend of beans from Peru and Brazil. that mirror some of TR's favorite flavor profiles. But they also do an incredible job in sourcing from reliable farmers, hardworking people, and so their stories get told with our coffee as well.
So Candace, you're the boss now. You're the boss. You're the executive chef. That's a big title. And I saw you scurrying around the kitchen and making sure things are going right with a sort of soft opening that we have here today. How are you as a boss? We know you as a chef and a creative person in the kitchen. How are you as the one in charge?
You know, I think that every day I tell my team how appreciative of them I am. And so far we're all working really well together. I think that my job isn't to be the one cooking everything, you know, nitpicking people's plating, stuff like that. It's like my job is to make them better chefs than I am. I want them to have all these skill sets. I mean, it also makes my job really easy, right? If they know how to do everything, but I want them to be proud of their work. And so far, I mean, like I can trust them completely to execute these things and to make it exactly how I made it. It's simple, it's straightforward, and so we're building this menu out together, and the first menu is really easy. It'll get progressively harder through the season, and next year it'll be twice as hard, but I think that, you know, as long as they're invested in learning these things, we'll be in a good place.
So what's on this first menu?
Oh, so it's pretty much soup and sandwiches, some salads. We've got a smoked salmon salad with wild rice, shaved fennel, onions, herbs. And then we have a cedar smoked chicken kebab salad also. And that goes over cooked amaranth and oat groats, kale. And then we have, TR was a big fan of fried chicken. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So we have a fried chicken sandwich, and it's just like lightly dredged. It's seasoned with chilies and orange zest in the buttermilk, and then just fried. And it's like the only fried item we have. And I refuse to buy a deep fryer for this restaurant, but
there's no deep fryer in this restaurant.
There's no deep fryer. I refuse to buy a deep fryer because I don't want people, I feel like in hors d'oeuvre situations and big functions, people rely on a fryer to make tasty items, but it adds to that like intake that you don't want people to have. I mean, like we're pan frying, it's getting served with a pretty zesty cabbage slaw with some peppers in it, and then on our plain sourdough bread. We'll always have a green chili pozole or a vegetarian soup, and then TR's venison chili is another one. We have some fresh fruits, berries, a lot of salads, really. We've got a bulgur salad that we're going to put on the menu.
What's a bulgur salad?
It's cracked wheat. Yep. So kind of like a couscous type situation. But again, it's like layering using like staghorn sumac and citrus and herbs. And so that even though you're eating this like dense grain salad, the way your body responds to it is different because you have these ingredients that are incredible anti-inflammatories and, yeah, help with arthritis pain. It comes with a nettle dressing, and nettle is great for joint pain. But, yeah, just trying to slowly incorporate some of these foraged ingredients into people's diet so that they're a little bit more accepting or a little bit more curious and want to get out there and find it themselves.
So how has this kind of food and foraging, how in your everyday diet and what you eat, how has that helped make you healthier, have better gut health, mental health, whatever the case might be? You recovered from a very serious car accident. How has food and what you eat played a role in that kind of healing?
Well, I've always kind of noticed the differences, but really it comes from me cooking for other people. And my grandma's diabetic. Like, I've had friends that have been going through cancer or different things. And so then I research, like, what can I do for them to make this work for their body? And there was a person that had me cater their birthday party. And he was allergic to everything. I mean, like, insane amount of allergies. Potatoes, onions, garlic, tomatoes, gluten, most red meat. He could have bison, but yeah, so I curated a 3-course menu for his birthday, and he had about 60 people there, and he could eat everything, and everyone ate everything also, and no one had a complaint. They said everything was delicious, and so for him to be able to participate in something like that, and for everyone to be able to enjoy what he's able to have also, was a really big thing for me, and that I want that experience for everybody. Someone came in here a while ago and said that they felt like every time they ate my food, I was cooking for them. And so I don't know if there could be a bigger compliment in that, like, that is how I feel. That is what I want to do. I want to cook like I'm cooking for the person I love, and for that person to receive that in that way.
Well, and it was in the aftermath of your car accident, which was quite serious. You were airlifted to a hospital, and it was bad, but you lost some of your senses. And part of the hard part about that, where you gave up cooking for a while, was that you couldn't cook for your son effectively. You didn't know what combination was going to taste good to him. And then it was a long road, but I know, like, meditation and things like that were part of your healing from that, and being able to recover a lot of those senses. Are you, I don't want to say fully recovered, but are you able to sort of use most of your taste and your smell to prepare and create dishes?
So there are some items that have never changed, like underripe fruit. I'd say, like, I can tell when something's close to spoilage more now also, and that, like, it'll smell like chemical. I find, like, I keep chickens, even my eggs smell different from what I buy in the grocery store, and I thought that was interesting. They taste different too to me. And so being able to source from reliable farmers and getting things fresh have definitely changed how I eat. But yeah, I'd say a lot of things just taste like chemicals to me still. So when I'm in the kitchen, I'll try things, but I very much rely on my staff. Like, how does it taste? What's the texture like? Like I can tell you those things too, but, like, I would say I do just, like, go off of memory. When I really meditate on what something tastes like, I can taste it. And it doesn't always mean that it'll land on the plate that way. And so I have to trust my team.
You really could have gone anywhere. You could be Carmi in the kitchen eyeing for that one or two Michelin stars somewhere. You could be in Twin Cities, Chicago, but you're in North Dakota. You stayed in this region. Obviously, Fargo was a big launching point for you, and it's still very much part of you. Now you're out here in the Badlands. Why here? Why this job versus any other star-making job anywhere?
It really has everything to do with the greater mission. For this to be an Indigenous-inspired restaurant, and for us to have partnerships with the Indigenous community here on this property. I went most of my childhood not seeing a lot of representation in museums and stuff like that, or engagement with the community, with the Native American community. And what they're doing here is exactly what I want for my son, right? I want him to see himself wherever he goes. I want him to see what's possible when it comes to land stewardship and conservation and foodways and how all of that ties into our culture.
Do you have plans to interact with some of the tribes around here and collaborate with them on events and other educational opportunities?
Yeah, so our programs and education department are, like, facilitating a lot of that, but we are working with MHA on a lot of different projects, and I think, like, it's really just, like, getting going. I'm involved more so in the medicinal garden that we're planting, but we're also going to have a community garden next year, and it's going to be Indigenous-led. I want to expand my network when it comes to Native American farmers and get more of their products in our restaurant, as long as it's relatively close by. But yeah, I think that the doors are just, like, now opening for a lot of these things. Even with myself, there was hesitation to join this project because of how TR viewed Native Americans and how my family kind of responded to the job.
How did they?
Cautious. You know, they're like, is that what you really want to do? And I the reason I came out here was because of the land blessing ceremony and how they engaged with the Native American community. And I felt like that meant something to me, but also there were so many cues in my life that kind of led me back to this, where I had all of the tools needed to really push this project in a direction that I saw beneficial for both. And so still just kind of following that path and becoming more engaged with my community. And I mean, like, really, like, they show up. They do. Like, whenever, like, we need something, they're like, no, I want to be a part of that too. And it feels so good to have that, because I hadn't had it when I lived in D.C. or New York or North Carolina, you know. And so, yeah.
Yeah, the one of the biggest stages where you can certainly teach people a lot of things about Indigenous culture and foodways is just an awesome way to do it. But, you know, I was just listening to National Native News yesterday on my way from Dickinson to here, and the story was about, well, America 250 and the feelings about that, but it was the day before, now it's the day of, the 150th anniversary of Little Bighorn, and the woman that was being interviewed said, I'm going to celebrate that and not the America 250. So imagine, TR is complicated, the history is complicated, but it seems like they're showing and sharing kind of all of it. But I imagine, you tell me, are your feelings complicated around the history surrounding Theodore Roosevelt? And how have you kind of, you mentioned talking with your family, how have you personally felt about it and grappled with any internal dialogue?
I would say that being brought into the project, I did have a lot of reservations, and that in certain situations you can be used as a product, basically. But for like our CEO and for all of our leadership team that I've been working with since 22, we've all become very close, and their intentions are very tied into this mission. I think, like, the greatest part about our leadership team is that we do share a lot of the same virtues. I can't remember who I said it to, but I was just like, if I don't have a voice, I don't want to do this. And they've never put me in a situation where I couldn't be myself, that I couldn't, you know, stand up for what I believe in. And I've gotten feedback from the Native American community, like, why would you do that? But when you have the right people with you, when you have the right allies, and you're pursuing the right mission, it makes all the difference. And for every space that I've been in and not being able to see a Native American face or someone that represents our people and our history, I want that to change. And it starts with us being present everywhere.
That's just it. It's representation, it's being present, being visible. And that's the step that you can take. And well, I was going to ask you, what was your pitch to them to choose you as executive chef? But I should ask, what was their pitch to you? They're very lucky to have gotten you for this job. How did they convince you to take it?
Yeah, I came out for that land blessing ceremony, and afterwards, like, everyone just, like, gave me hugs and, like, thanked me for my work. And I really thought that that would be it, and that I wouldn't do anything like that for a while. But the CEO, Ed O'Keefe, he reached out to me, and I met him at the Fargo office, and he was just like, I don't know what you want to do, but I would like you to be involved. And I was like, okay. And so it just kind of, like, took off, where I was doing more facilitating of what the restaurant will look like, and picking out equipment and doing mock menus and stuff like that. I'm like, this is what you can do in this space.
You helped design, like, the space inside here?
Yes. So it was, like, the back of house kitchen and then this servery area. So, like, how it would be laid out, what type of equipment we would need, and, like, staffing, all of that. And so kind of just, like, building it from the bottom, and then I wasn't really sure where it was going to go, but I was like, I would like to help open. And of course, like, the restaurant that I worked for in Fargo closed. And so when that happened, I was like, if you guys have availability, I was like, I'd like to do more. And they were like, yes, of course. And so I started right away, and then, yeah, really just started doing more events out here for donors, for staff. yeah, participating in all the development and seeing the construction unfold and picking out office furniture and like sitting in things, testing things. It was a lot of fun, and now I'm here.
Like, these tables are all like beer hall style long tables. Why did you decide to do it that way?
We can break it up a little bit, but the purpose of having more family style tables is to get people talking to one another. I come out and maybe I won't sit right next to somebody, but I'll introduce myself, see how their meal is, see how they're doing, or, you know, just give families room to spread out. The intention is for you to be able to see the space wide open and then go outside and enjoy it. And I see a lot of people bring larger families into, and I really love to see that.
What's the, so far, what's the favorite on the menu that people are going nuts for?
I don't know. Everyone kind of has said that they have different favorites. The roasted bison sandwich with tomato jam is pretty great. And then I'm all about the smoked salmon salad, to be honest.
Sold.
Yeah.
Candace, this is amazing. Congratulations on this very fine job in this beautiful setting. You're going to just open up a lot of hearts and taste buds too, I think. So congrats.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Theodore Roosevelt Library's executive chef, Candace Stock, in conversation with Eric Dethridge. Eric will have more from the library during our live coverage on Saturday, Independence Day, starting at 11 o'clock Central, 10 o'clock Mountain on Prairie Public. Eric will take you around the inside and outside of the stunning facility. Dave Thompson will bring you the play-by-play of the opening ceremony, and Dickinson State Roosevelt scholar Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane will provide historical context and analysis. Join us on the 4th for North Dakota's shining historical moment. Still to come on Main Street, as the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library opens in Medora, a new North Dakota Monitor investigation examines one of the most difficult aspects of Roosevelt's legacy, his documented views on race and Native Americans. And we'll end today's program with a complete reading of the Declaration of Independence from one of North Dakota's most trusted voices. This is a closer look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. Theodore Roosevelt's influence on North Dakota is impossible to overstate. His time in the Badlands helped shape the man who became the nation's 26th president, and the legacy is woven into the state's identity through parks, monuments, and now the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. But Roosevelt's story is also more complicated than many people realize. A recent investigation by North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge explores Roosevelt's own words about race and Native Americans, the impact those beliefs had on federal policy, and how historians and the new Presidential Library are presenting a fuller picture of one of America's most influential presidents. Jacob joins us now for a closer look with the Monitor. Jacob, how are you today?
I'm doing okay. Thanks, Craig.
Why was this the right time for you to report on this story as the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library prepares to open?
Well, this is a big moment for North Dakota. We have this presidential library that's opening, that's been built, that is being dedicated this week. And I wanted to look at an aspect of Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as a man and as a president. We obviously hear as North Dakotans a lot of stories about his time in the Badlands, his policies as president, how many aspects of his legacy continue to pay dividends for the United States to this day.
Jacob, before we get into the details of your writing, what central question did you want your story to answer?
Well, Craig, the central question that I wanted answered in my article were how Native Americans feel about Teddy Roosevelt and the library that's going to bear his name. And also, as a secondary question, how the library is going to approach this part of his legacy. What we hear less about, or what I perceived us as hearing less about, was his views on race and Native American voices on this topic. In addition to some of those primary source documents, I also spoke to a wide-ranging group of Native Americans, historians, and North Dakotans. And the almost unanimous view is that he made a lot of remarks in his lifetime that are quite frankly racist. Robbie Loff, the executive director of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, was recently at a Prairie Public event where he said that he doesn't even want to repeat some of the remarks that Teddy Roosevelt made during his lifetime on race and Native Americans. One of the most infamous quotes that Roosevelt said from an 1886 speech in New York, he said, quote, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of every 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th, end quote. And a lot of these remarks, a lot of these quotes that you see from Roosevelt on race are still hurtful to Native Americans to this day. I spoke to Scott Davis, the former executive director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, and he said that a lot of tribal leaders still remember that quote like it was yesterday. Now, there are some caveats to this. Those were common views at the time. And Roosevelt's family, I spoke to a member of that family, Serena Roosevelt, they say that Roosevelt changed his views later in life and that he evolved as a person and that he was ashamed of some of his earlier remarks. But there doesn't seem to be much doubt that he made a lot of racist remarks during his lifetime.
Jacob, I'm curious, beyond the rhetoric, how did those beliefs influence the policies Roosevelt supported or pursued while he was president?
Teddy Roosevelt supported several policies while he was president that resulted in long-term harm to Native Americans and Native American communities, consequences that are still being felt today. Many historians I spoke to emphasized that it's important to bear in mind many of these policies began before Roosevelt was president and ended well after he left office. But those same historians say it's also fair to hold Teddy Roosevelt accountable for the policies that he supported and helped to implement. Among those policies were the Allotment Acts, which, to summarize a very complicated process, was essentially privatizing land that had previously been collectively held by tribal nations. Among these, among the consequences from that policy is the checkerboard of property ownership that you see on some reservations. The overall goal here from Teddy Roosevelt's point of view was to try and assimilate Native Americans into mainstream American culture. But in the end, that was not successful, but it did. A lot of these policies did contribute to the loss of land, the loss of language, and the loss of culture that a lot of Native Americans are still struggling to repair to this day.
The Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library has said in that speech, I think, that you were talking about earlier, that it wants to present a complete picture of Roosevelt, not just the inspiring parts. From your understanding, how is the library approaching these more difficult conversations?
The library and a historian associated with the library have told me that they are going to be approaching this topic head on. Their mantra has been to humanize, not lionize, Teddy Roosevelt. And they've involved Native Americans throughout this process as they're developing the content of what this library is going to include. That began back in 2021-2022 with Burgum and outreach to tribal leaders and the Roosevelt family. That initial process culminated in a blessing of the land before construction began. And that was from everybody's account, that seems to have been a very emotional day where representatives of the Roosevelt family and tribal leaders gathered here in North Dakota and shared stories, and the Roosevelt family emphasized that they do not share the views that Teddy Roosevelt so controversially expressed. And that involvement of Native American voices in the process has continued in recent years. There's an advisory council that exists and advises the library on how to better incorporate Native American history and the consequences of some of Roosevelt's policies into the library. And a lot of the Native American leaders that I spoke to are hoping that the Teddy Roosevelt Library will be a platform for Indigenous history and tell the whole story and bring Native American perspectives to the forefront rather than focusing just on the more positive aspects of Teddy Roosevelt's legacy. And so far, it seems as if the library is pursuing that tack.
Anything, Jacob, in your reporting that was genuinely surprising to you or challenged your own understanding of Theodore Roosevelt?
I would say one minor surprise I encountered early on was some surprise at the extent of Teddy Roosevelt's racism in some of his remarks and his policies, and that a lot of these policies are still resulting in consequences that are felt today.
Your story, Jacob, isn't really about canceling a historical figure. It's about understanding one more completely, I feel. What does this conversation tell us about how we should approach a complicated historical figure in general?
You're right, Craig. This is absolutely not about canceling Teddy Roosevelt or anybody else. This was a look at an aspect of TR's legacy that is not as often discussed as other parts of his time in the Badlands. One historian I spoke to said that they can't think of a perfect president. So everyone has a complicated legacy, and Teddy Roosevelt in particular was a complicated man. He's celebrated for a lot of policies that, as I mentioned earlier, continue to benefit the United States. But he also supported policies and made remarks that continue to cause harm to this day. And I think that's something that we all have to factor in when we're talking about this.
After spending so much time researching and reporting on this piece, what do you hope readers take away from it?
My goal with this piece, Craig, was to center Native American perspectives and thoughts on the library. And I hope readers can come away with a more complete understanding of that aspect of TR's legacy. And hopefully they'll have the opportunity to visit the library and see their take on a lot of these and other aspects of TR's life and legacy.
Many of us are looking forward to doing exactly that, Jacob. Jacob Orledge is a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. His story examines the complexities of Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as North Dakota marks the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. You can read his full reporting, free from paywalls, free from requirement of a subscription. You can read it at the North Dakota Monitor at northdakotamonitor.com. Jacob, thanks again for joining us with a closer look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Kathleen Risch Charitable Fund, proud to support trusted journalism, education, and the future of public broadcasting. Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. As our nation prepares to celebrate its 250th birthday, it's worth returning to the words that helped begin the American experiment. On July 4, 1776, delegates to the Second Continental Congress approved the Declaration of Independence, a document that announced to the world that 13 colonies would become a new nation founded on the principles of liberty, equality, and self-government. Nearly 2.5 centuries later, those words continue to inspire discussion, debate, and reflection about who we are as Americans and who we strive to become. Today, we're honored to present a complete reading of the Declaration of Independence, narrated by one of Prairie Public's most familiar and respected voices, Merrill Pepcorn.
In Congress, July 4th, 1776. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused to assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial, from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and he has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury, whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the restitute of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
A reading of the Declaration of Independence, narrated by Merrill Pepcorn. As America approaches its 250th anniversary, The Declaration remains more than a historical document. It is a reminder of the ideals upon which the nation was founded, and an invitation for each generation to consider what liberty, equality, and self-government can mean in its own time. We hope you consider reflecting on those enduring words as our nation commemorates this historic milestone. Happy Independence Day from all of us at Prairie Public.